I first met Chuck Allison on the C++ Standards Committee, where we both served for many years. Chuck was an editor for CUJ, the C and C++ Users Journal, from 1992 through 2003. As senior editor for the last of those years, he oversaw all technical aspects of the journal. He authored C and C++ code capsules, and Chuck and I co-authored Thinking in C++ Volume 2, both published by Prentice Hall. After over 20 years as a software developer, he is now an assistant professor of computer science at Utah Valley State College in Orem, Utah, and speaks regularly at conferences. First, you will hear a presentation on code quality that Chuck gave to the computer science students at his college. This presentation was based on the technical summit that Scott Myers, Bill Venners, Chuck, and I organized in Portland, Oregon, January 15th through 17th, 2003. The slides for the presentation can be found on this CD, and you can also find the slides for a later version of the presentation that Chuck gave as the keynote address to the 2004 ACCU Spring Conference in Oxford, England. Following this, I interview Chuck. Since he is more than anything an educator, we talked about what makes a good programmer and how this can be taught.
So just to give you a little background, I did attend a summit. There were 15 attendees in Portland, Oregon from January 15th through 17th. Let me tell you that what this was a group of people who care about code quality, and they paid for themselves to go. It cost me $700 out of my own pocket to go to this summit. And so there are some people who care enough and want to get enough insight into this problem that we did that. Plus, it was kind of fun to kowtow with some pretty cool people in the industry. Naturally, it's always fun to do. But our agenda focused on three major things. How bad are things now? We'll talk about that. And how did they get that way? Because, of course, if we can understand that, we can understand maybe how we can fix it. And that's the last question. How can these things be fixed? Just to give you an idea of who was there, this all started last summer when Scott Myers, raise your hand if you've heard of Scott Myers. There's a number of hands going up. Scott Myers is a very famous and well-respected authority in the C++ world worldwide. He has been, let us just be frank here, upset with the quality of software. He doesn't like it when his software doesn't behave the way it should. And so he was talking to Bruce Eckel, another, of course, very well-known person in our industry. And Bruce has done a number of summits of this nature where he just gets people together and let's talk about it and see what we can come up with. So they started talking about it, and Bruce decided to get myself and Bill Venners involved in this. And so last August, we put our heads together, mostly through email, of course, for a couple of months and talked about this and decided what do we want to do and whom do we want to invite to this summit. We looked around at the industry of the people that we knew or have heard of and wanted to know who would be an asset. And so we put together quite an interesting group. The names of the rest of the people are here on the right. Two of them are from England. Actually, one lives there now, but that's not true. There's three Brits on the group, but only one of them is still living there. And then there's also someone from Germany. Angelika Langer flew all the way in at her own expense from Germany to join us. These people are authors of a number of books. You may have seen some of these books around. Some of them very, very well known. Not only just C++ books, there's also a Java book there. One of the highest selling Java books is Effective Java by Joshua Block. He works at Sun, and he was here at the summit. And there's some books there on just programming in general and not about languages. So it was quite an interesting group. And we got together to talk about how bad things are. And so I'm supposing that in your minds you're thinking, what do you mean? What do you mean things are bad? Are things bad? Your code isn't bad, right? Now, careful. I've had some of you in class, so I know better than that. The thing is that programming used to be a real black art. Back in the days when computers first came around, they were these big monstrous things that cost millions of dollars. You know all about this. And the hardware was the great expense. The software was just kind of something you put up with because the hardware got all your attention. And so a lot of interesting practices, very clever practices, were employed. And some of the professors here at UVSC have had enough experience, and I know that Roger certainly can attest to this. that in the old days, you were there in the old days, right, Roger? Yeah. Oh, the things we would do to get an extra bite out of our machine because of the limitations that they had. And so programming was really a black art. And of course, members of this black art priesthood would always glory in their clever tricks of doing that. But it wasn't just in the 50s and in the 60s. It was also in the 80s. I remember in 1983, I got my first home computer. So exciting. It was a VIC-20. Ever hear of a VIC-20? Guess how much RAM it had? 3.5K. And so I had a Pac-Man game on that. And this Pac-Man game was what we call self-modifying code. Part of the load-up logic had to be overwritten by the real logic after the program was loaded so it had enough room to run. So those are the kind of tricks that people used to do. So software has a bit of a history of why it's kind of a hodgepodge and very mysterious. So the inevitable result is there has been and continues to be a software crisis. Nobody wanted to admit it. They finally did in 1968 at a very large, very famous symposium. And so the term software crisis was coined, and guess what? It has not gone away. So, how bad are things now? Well, first of all, Scott Myers is upset. That ought to be enough to get something done. If you know Scott Myers, and like I say, millions of people do throughout the world, he commands a lot of attention, and he is no wallflower. He likes to be heard. And so something is going to happen one way or another, and it's because of Scott that we had this summit. Nonetheless, there are some other people that are upset as well. Here are some statistics. Now, the first one's a little flaky, but it's pretty much true. About half of all software projects in industry don't make it. The products never get deployed. And believe it or not, there are programs out there that hang. I don't know if you've ever had that happen. Or they fail to meet the specification for which they were originally commissioned. Another thing, how many here are actually working as a programmer somewhere? Raise your hand. Okay. Have you had enough experience to agree with me on the next bullet that schedule and budget overruns are a cliche? They just happen. Look at all those nods out there. Yeah, it just happens all the time. Why does that happen? It's a problem. It's a big problem. Software is complex. Here's another one that you probably appreciate. Help desks are woefully understaffed and overworked. Okay, well, the question is, why do we need help desks in the first place? And so that's something worth thinking about. If software did what it was supposed to do, and if it was clear and understandable, why do we have these people who get very rude with you after a while, by the way? I've had some very, very nasty experiences. And I'll even name some companies. Shall I do that for you? A little gossip here. I've had some very unprofessional people deal with me with Oracle, the database, and with Borland C++. Very amazing. The people obviously, I want to say this properly, but the person at Borland thought he was just so brilliant because he knew Borland C++, and he was trying to teach me the basics of C++, and I was on the committee. And I was calling because there was a problem with his compiler, not with my knowledge of C++. He wasn't very happy with that. Okay, this last bullet is the most important. I'd like you to remember this one all the way throughout the talk because I'm going to bring it up again. There has been a recent report that was published in the communications of the ACM, research by the National Institute of Standards and Technology, that the estimated cost of software bugs in the U.S. alone annually is $60 billion. How do you feel about that? $60 billion. Could you use $60 billion? Do you think the industry could use it? Do you think that maybe if $60 billion were distributed throughout the software industry in the United States right now, maybe we'd be in a little better shape economically in that sector of our industry? $60 billion is enough to make a difference. And it's there because of poor quality. The question is, how much would it cost to rectify that? That research has not been done, but you're going to see later that I'm going to assert that the cost will be less than $60 billion. And I'll show you why I believe that to be true coming up shortly. Okay, have there been any software disasters? Well, there certainly have. There has been the Mars Polar Lander. That was a year or two ago. I can't remember when that was, but unfortunately it didn't quite do what it was supposed to do. It was a software problem. You want to read about it? There's the URL. American Airlines Flight 965, very, very sad situation. It was a user interface problem. It confused the pilot, and he went into a mountain instead of over it. You can read about that in that book that's quoted there. And the fact that $60 billion is wasted, to me, is a disaster. I don't know how you feel. Certainly, there's something we can do. And since we must have full disclosure, we must admit that some of your programming assignments are also software disasters. No offense, but I've seen them. Yep, and I actually asked one of my students last semester, why do you do this? And he says, job security. Right. Okay, we'll move on. Okay, how did things get so bad? Well, there's a lot to say. I'll just focus on some things that I think that this audience will appreciate and that we can get some conclusions from. Part of it is management. Of course, we love to blame someone else, right? So naturally, we'll just blame the managers, and that should be the end of it. But that's not the end of it, and that's not even all of it, but it's part of it. There is part of the blame that goes to management. And again, I'm not here necessarily to cast blame, but to learn what can we do to fix things. Another thing is development tools, and I'm going to say some things that I've said before in smaller settings. I'll say them here, and we'll see what kind of reaction we get. It's a good thing the more the faculty aren't here to throw things at me. And then programmer skill level, of course, has got to be a very big part of this. So let's talk about some of these things. Stupid management tricks, borrowing a little bit here from David Letterman. It is pretty much a cliche that the uninformed manager expects the impossible from the under-supported. That is so true. Just get the job done. Now, it's nice to just get the job done, but we need to be supported in doing that. Too many managers micromanage the details of development. They want to tell us how long it's going to take to develop some software. That's backwards. That's not the way it should be. They should say, here's what we need to do. Here's the goals. We meet with the users, and they ask us, how long will it take? Now, we can negotiate that, of course. And there's some degrees of freedom there. We can say, well, we can do this much in this much time. If you really have to have a deadline, what do you absolutely have to have by that time? But the answer to getting software done on time and with quality is not to say, just make it happen in an impossible length of time or with resources undersupplied. Furthermore, managers often make technical decisions that they do not have the current expertise to make. And that often causes a lot of problems. And naturally, they demand overtime. They forget you have a life, and they think of you as just something that's a bottom line on a spreadsheet. Now, that's not true of all managers, of course. And I had a very good manager, as some of you know, I talked about before I came here when I worked at Novell. But that is part of the problem. Now, there is always pressure to meet market deadlines, and there's nothing wrong with that. We all know that the first person who gets to market with a reasonably good product is going to command a lot of market share, and that's good business. And so we can't fault management for that pressure. But in the rush to make a deadline, corners are cut, and there's not time to do all of the quality software engineering that you have to do. That's to be expected. But if you leave it there, that is when problems occur. Once you meet that release, what needs to be done is there needs to be some time scheduled to go back and now fix those corners that you cut so that the quality of the software is what it should be. Too many managers don't have the long-term thinking to do that. And of course, as I said, sometimes we don't get the resources or even the training and the mentoring that we need. Let me tell you a couple of stories. 1997 and 98, I was self-employed as a trainer and consultant. I traveled all over the country teaching C++ and Java to corporations. And in August of 1998, I had a gig in DC with NASA to teach them Java. And so I got there, I had the usual problems getting there. The plane was delayed, and it was a bit of an uncomfortable trip, and I finally got there, and I showed up at 8 in the morning to the parking lot of NASA, and there's somebody with this negative look on his face to meet me, like, oh, he dreads what he's about to have to tell me. But he intercepts me before I get into the building, and he says, I'm sorry, we're going to have to cancel. Oh, how come? Well, our boss is mad at us because of all the bugs in our software. We just did a release and there were too many bugs, and so he canceled our training. Now, of course, they ended up paying me half of what they would have paid me anyway. I mean, you know, you have to stay in business, you have to have agreements like that, right? I can't fly out there at my own expense and earmark a whole week for them and then not get a penny for it. And that's not good business. And so I ended up getting 50% of what I would have been given without teaching a thing, because they had bugs in their software. And therefore, we're not going to train you. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? At Hughes Aircraft, in the 80s, I was getting some expertise in database systems and the tools to do certain applications very, very rapidly. And I was in a department called engineering support. Our job was to support the various departments with programming and engineering-related activities that they could not do with their own expertise. And so I had a couple of representatives from one department come to me, and they said, you know, we'd like you to help us with this problem. And it was a data-related problem. And so I sat down and in 15 minutes had a prototypical solution ready for them. That's all it took me with the great tools that were available to me at the time with the Ingress database management system. And their eyes grew large and they go, wow, just wait till we tell our boss this. This is cool. So I didn't hear from them for a while and I thought, what's going on here? Don't they want us to do this for them? I mean, it took 15 minutes to do most of the solution. We can solve it for them in a day and be done. Well, I had to finally call them, and they sheepishly said, well, we told our boss all about it, and he said, well, we've always been doing things this way. We're going to keep doing them the way we've been doing them. Stupid management tricks. How about that? Okay, and the next one was my own manager. He shared with me one day his philosophy of training. He says, I look upon training as a perk for a job well done. So if you do very good on your current assignment, maybe you'll get to get some training in something someday. Now that makes a lot of sense too, doesn't it? All right, so there is a problem there. And I'll talk a little bit more later about training versus mentoring and how important they are. Oklahoma experiences. Let me just summarize that by saying that I taught at a very leading company at the time in telecommunications, a company who is now having severe financial troubles, and you don't hear much about them anymore, but they were the biggest one at one time. So you can probably guess who they were. I'll tell you later if you come up and ask. And I had some regular training gigs with them. And here I find them on the other end of the scale. Instead of not providing training or mentoring, what they did is they just took any warm body you could think of and put them in training. I'm having the most frustrating experience of my training career trying to teach these people C++, and I'm wondering, why aren't they getting it? Turns out they're all help desk people. They just figured it would be nice if they knew a little C++, so we'll just throw them in there. And they paid for this training. That's the other extreme, stupid management tricks. Okay, now, as I said, programming tended to be looked upon as a black art. And so a reaction to that was, well, we're going to take this away from the programmers. We don't like these programmers sitting in a corner doing these things we don't understand. So let's come up with something to make things more tractable to the average person. Let's invent COBOL, which is a very good thing. COBOL was an attempt to make code readable, almost as if it were English prose, for electronic bookkeeping. And it was a very great innovation. And as a matter of fact, to this day, it may still be true that there's more lines of COBOL being used than anything else. For all I know, that may still be true. But of course, if you knew how many lines of COBOL it took to do something, you'd understand why there's more lines of COBOL than there is something else. Anyway, they thought for sure at this time. Do you remember these days, Roger? They thought for sure that COBOL was going to be the end of this programmer black magic, because now everybody's going to be able to understand this stuff, even managers, because it's English. Well, it did solve bookkeeping problems, but guess what? Programmers are still here. The next major attempt in history was the bringing on of the fourth generation languages in the 80s, and these especially had to do with databases. This is what I used to solve a problem in 15 minutes. They were great. They were really great, but they were visual tools that allowed you to do what you can do with visual tools. But guess what? You can't do everything with visual tools. Programming is not mouse engineering, and it's important that we all understand that. And we have a similar problem with the tools that you and I use today. And this is where I have to get into heated debates with certain other people. When you use Visual Studio, when you use JBuilder, and you're doing a visual application, it's very good for putting together the visual part of an application. But do you realize that is only part of an application? And then when you have a large software system, the most intelligence does not go into how you present it to the users. It's to the object model and its behavior and its complexities of solving the real problem, independent of how it's given to the user. And so the problem with some of these tools is that they make it so, just like the COBOL mentality, I can read English, therefore I can program. I can push buttons, therefore I can program. And that's just plain not true. And so what we have is we have an industry with a large number of people who can press buttons but do not understand programming. So as I say, they're great tools in the right hands, but they make people... I mean, you've got an interactive environment, you can push a button to compile, and then you can debug it. What else is there, right? And so you end up throwing up code before thinking about it and debugging it. You haven't really programmed, and I hope you'll see that by the time we're done. We're going to say more about that. Another problem with these visual tools is that prototypes have tended to become products before their time. A prototype, as you know, is just a quick mock-up to say, here's how we can do this. But managers in the past have seen that and they'd say, great, put that in production. And it's not ready. It's just a facade. And yet, how many projects have come to life because of that? So, again, poor decisions. Now, let me just briefly mention and give you some references if you want to study on this controversial topic that I have, this thing that you know I have, those of you that know me, about visual programming. Again, visual and even event-driven programming, visual event-driven programming only deals with user interface. It does not get at the complexities of the real problem that lie beneath the surface. And there's an article coming out in April in the C++ Users Journal, which is one of the best things I've read about this topic. It's called Who Moved My State? And so when that comes out, I'd suggest you look at it. I'd also like to just leave one more thought as we leave this particular topic, and that is, guess what? Programmers don't need to do GUIs. I worked at two companies where they never did because they had people whose job was to do that. User specialists, human factors engineers, they used the visual tools and they defined things the way they should. And did you see the Dilbert comic last September? Alice was at the doctor and she's sick and the doctor says, I'm sorry, you have a case of my job is crappus. And then he says, but still, you have other symptoms that aren't explained by this. Have you been exposed to interfaces designed by engineers lately? Yes. I'm sorry, you'll be dead within a week. So that's more true than you think. And so wrench yourself, if you can, from thinking that programming is visual, because that's just a facade. Okay, I'm going to be quoting from one of the greatest sages of all time in computer science. His name is Edsger Dijkstra. And the first quote from Mr. Dijkstra today is, "The effective exploitation of his powers of abstraction must be regarded as one of the most vital activities of a competent programmer. Programming is not just pushing buttons and drawing pictures. It's the ability to abstract, to create new semantic levels to solve a real problem that has not been solved before in software." Please try to remember that. Now, this dumbing down of programming has had some pretty bad effects. And the truth of the matter is, programming is indeed a complex intellectual process. Wetware is required. You know what wetware is? The stuff between your ears. It's your brain. You can't do programming without it. A good programmer is an abstractionist. He's a designer. He's an engineer. He's also an artist, because sometimes it takes some finesse to solve a problem that hasn't been solved before. And he's also a craftsperson because he cares about what he's doing. So more words of wisdom. Programming will remain very difficult, and that, I assert, will never change. No matter how many neat tools we come up to solve an existing problem, and those are wonderful. GUIs are great for what they're intended for. But programming will remain very difficult because once we have freed ourselves from the circumstantial cumbersomeness, we find ourselves free to tackle the problems that are now well beyond our programming capacity. Today, that's pretty obvious, isn't it? But when he gave this talk in 1972, it wasn't all that obvious. We're doing things with computers today that were never dreamed of, and it will continue to be that way, and we will continue to have to be thinkers. This idea of having so many people enter the industry of programming because they can push buttons, has been called by some the battle of the exponents, and we're losing it. What we mean is it's so easy to start programming, or at least think you're a programmer now, that the number of programmers, and you might want to put that in quotes, has increased orders of magnitude faster than the people who can mentor and train them properly. We're losing that battle. It's growing too fast, and what are we going to do about it? We don't have an answer to that yet, but we can at least can ask the question, did making programming easier pay off? And the answer is yes and no. Okay, you all had physics. Raise your hand if you've had physics yet. What's entropy? Here's a definition. You've heard of entropy, right? Especially, I think you might have to get to the second semester of physics to get that one. I'm looking at Anthony's face, and he's thinking, I've had physics, but I don't know what entropy is. But here's the definition for the dictionary. It's a measure of the disorder in a closed system. Another way, a better way to say that is it's the inevitable and steady deterioration of a system. The second law of thermodynamics, basically in layman's terms, says that stuff happens. Everything gets worse. Things go downhill. Things deteriorate. And it's certainly true most of the time. It's a law of nature. It's true of our bodies. Hey, just ask me. I'm almost the oldest one in the room. And it's also true of closed systems. And it turns out it's true of software. When you have a system of some complexity and you keep adding to it, it's too hard to keep track of. The entropy increases. It just becomes more complex. The disorder increases. How do you fight that? It takes intelligence to do that. It takes intelligence and work and time to do that. And if you don't do it, the utter result is to die. And that's what happens to software. It has a life cycle. Can we preserve that and make it a little bit longer? Yes, we can. One of the things that has been obvious to many people for many years, but now has an official name, is the art of refactoring. It's just called changing your code, redesigning and re-implementing your code so that it is fresher, so that it has a cleaner internal structure so that it can be dealt with. Because if you just add things forever and never change what's there to accommodate the new stuff, then have you ever seen a house that's kind of been that way? I mean, you know, somebody adds onto the house and then 10 years later they add on some more. And it's a hodgepodge. It doesn't look like it was really meant to be. It's like three different houses in one. But on the other hand, you've probably seen people gut their house and remodel it. And that's a very different thing. They're willing to get inside the infrastructure, make a change, fundamentally redo things as needed, and out comes something really neat. And that's the difference. You can do the same thing with your code, and you should. But who's going to pay for that? And who's going to say, yeah, you can go ahead and do this? That's part of the problem. If you've got code that works, the tendency, the short-term thinking is, hey, it works. It ain't broke. Don't fix it. But if you don't keep it clean during its lifetime, eventually you'll say, there's no way I can fix it. We got to throw it away. Here's some of the things that you can do in code to refactor. These are just a few taken from the book Refactoring by Martin Fowler. Add a new parameter. Extract a class. You see some code and all of a sudden, ooh, there's a class just waiting to be made in there. There's some data and some functionality that goes together. Make a class out of it. Extract a hierarchy of classes. Extract a method. I have that in bold because I'm going to show that to you in a few minutes. So these are things that you can do over time with your code to keep it so that it can stay alive and accommodate the progress that it needs to make. A fellow named Luke Homan in the Java world has come up with a concept called post-release entropy reduction. Very important concept. What we're saying is, yes, there's entropy in software. It's going to get more complex. It's going to get more disorderly. We can fix that, but only if we will take the time to fix it. Now, we can't do that when a release is pending. We understand that. We got to get out there and make our market window. Let's do that. However, when that is done, we will be wise if we take the time to clean the internal structure and fix the things that we did to get it out in a hurry. If you don't, you end up with what we call technical debt. There's a short-term cost to fixing technical debt, but there's also a long-term cost. And what is it today? $60 billion. $1,000. Here's a graph that illustrates what we're talking about. Consider a project, and what naturally is going to happen is as the complexity increases, entropy sets in, the quality goes down, the disorder increases. It's hard to fix that, especially when you have a release to make. If you do not take the time to fix some of those things you did to get out on deadline, then when you go to release two, you start where you left off, and entropy continues. And so this idea of post-release entropy reduction is to schedule some time after release to clean up, and then you'll find yourself not doing so bad. Here's another way to look at it. This is to look at the cost of not doing it. This is something from Alistair Coburn, who was there at the summit. He is claiming, and he's going to write a paper to this effect, that as you refactor as you go, when it's time to make changes, you know, and this is standard extreme programming nowadays, when it's time to add something to code, you refactor as needed. As you do that, you're paying a little bit of cost as you go, and it's additive, it's linear. If you do not, the increasing complexity of the code makes it so that it's more difficult to get in there and make the changes you need to make. And so the net effect is over time, the cost is exponential. And so you can see the difference between the lifetimes here. Right here, the increased lifetime is this distance here before a project gets so complex that it's perhaps not as profitable as it could be. Furthermore, you even have longer in its total lifetime before you have to retire it. So that's the idea. So refactoring, clean up your code. More words of wisdom. Those who want really reliable software will discover that they must find means of avoiding the majority of bugs to start with. And as a result of the programming process, the programming process will become cheaper. If you want more effective programmers, you will discover that they should not waste their time debugging. They should not introduce the bugs to start with. Now, I heard somebody laugh over there. And if this were an audience of testers, there would be roars right now. There would be belly laughs so big, because what testers do is find bugs. But can you see the principle here? The principle here is that prevention is better than cure. The better you are, the fewer bugs there are going to be. And that's the truth. And that's the idea. And there are practices that support this. And we should care about these, and we should do these to the best of our ability. Now, here's a nice way to understand the effect of quality of the skill level, the skill level of a programmer. What this curve represents, this productivity curve, is the optimal point of productivity. The way this graph works is think of the x-axis as the input. The more input we put into a process, we want to get output in return, right? And so the more resources we throw at our project, we certainly hope we're going to get something out of that that's going to be productive for us. And this is good business. And this is standard economics as well. And so it turns out that at the, you know, there's a point in that curve where the more input you put into the process, you get diminishing returns on output. And so it's not necessarily a good idea to keep throwing resources at a project when it's not going to give you more productivity. The question is, what is the shape of your curve? What is the shape of your company's curve? The higher your skill level, the more you push that curve out. So the more you get, the more output you get, the more value you get for input into the project effort. So the more skill you have, the more productive you will be. And so these practices are important. Now, Sheldon asked the question, how much is this going to cost? And is it really going to cost less than $60 billion to save the $60 billion? I don't know for sure, but I believe the answer is yes, and I offer as proof the Japanese automobile industry, because that's just what they did. What that previous graph I just showed you and the things I've been talking to you about, it's just what happened in the Japanese auto industry. And now we see some Japanese automakers that are setting the standard for quality, and they're profitable. And so it's a viable model. Now, part of that cost needs to be more than just training, but what we've been calling mentoring. At my first job, I had a mentor that took me under his wing, and that's the way it should always be. I was fresh out of school. I had a master's in mathematics. I was an okay programmer. But boy, I was a lot better when he was through with me, because he was there to answer questions for me and to give me guidance and to look at my code. And when I wanted to solve a problem, he didn't always give me the answer, but he led me along. He was there. A trainer's not there all the time. You hire a trainer, he comes in, turns on the fire hose, you drink from it, and then he leaves. But some mentoring needs to be long-term, and that makes a tremendous difference. All right, so I realize a lot of this has been advice for managers. Let's start talking about what programmers can do. So first, let's talk about some stupid programmer tricks. First of all is poor design. Again, that's that not thinking up front like you should be doing. Now, I don't mean this as in a personal attack, and we all can stand to improve. You know, I'm not perfect, and I know it. But I'm way better than you guys. No, that's okay. Strike that from the record. I didn't mean that. Actually, there's a couple of you out there that can give me a run for my money. Okay, poor design, of course, is a big problem. You choose a bad data structure. You're using the wrong container from the STL or from the Java collections, and you should be using a better one. Or you're using a poor algorithm. Use binary search instead of linear search. These are trivial examples, and you can't always apply them. But you know, get the idea, of course, is that you just choose the best thing. You want to prevent problems before they start. So that's one thing. One of the things I've seen over and over again is this idea of reinventing the wheel. First of all, people seem to reinvent the same wheel over and over. But some people are smart enough to hold on to it and reuse it. But what I mean also here is that there are some things that are available to you now. There is a standard library in the language that you're using. Do you know it? Do you know it well enough to know that what is in there, the chances are you can use it now instead of reinventing it yourself? I had this experience in the 90s at a large corporation that I used to work at. And I looked at this code, and again, no personal offense meant here, but it was written by COBOL programmers, but it was in C. So basically, it was COBOL with C syntax. Very verbose. Furthermore, they were reinventing things that were already in the standard C library. What are they thinking? And so the first thing I did when I got a little time is I took one of these modules, which was 7 pages, and rewrote it using the C library, and it was 1 page. And that makes it more readable, more maintainable. Why do that work when you don't have to do it? Another problem that we often have is, oh, here's some code I did. I want to do something like that. I think I'll copy and paste that and put it over here. You have just replicated bugs. Congratulations. You've turned your editor into a bug replication tool. I'm going to talk about this again in a moment, but be careful about code replication. There's a better way. Inadequate testing, of course, and extreme programming tells us that testing first and then programming is faster than just programming. It seems to be proven true. And then, of course, many people don't seem to get beyond their initial imprint when they get out of school. They've learned something, and they think that's what programming is, but the truth of the matter is it's just the beginning. That's why graduation is called commencement. It means it's a beginning. And so you need to be able to change paradigms as you leave, and it's fun to do so. Let's give an example of the problems of code duplication. First of all, it comes in a couple of forms. You actually do it on purpose, or as you continue to code, you need to recognize that there's patterns of code that are pretty much identical. Why don't I factor those out and put them in one place? It's important to do that. Because if you don't, you have a maintenance nightmare. And let me give you two examples. You all know that when you define constants, you should do them symbolically, right? You shouldn't use magic numbers throughout your program, like 10 here and here and here, when they mean the same thing. What you do is you declare a constant, give it a name, like size or whatever it is, and say equals 10, and then you put size, size, size in different places throughout your code, right? And that way, you only have to change it once if it needs to change. So the point is you have one definition for one abstract entity. Code is the same way. When you duplicate code in different places, you've got something that should be factored out and done once, and you just refer to it in different places. You shouldn't be repeating yourself that way. And think upon that as a form of automation, because you don't have to manually redo it. Here's an example. A silly little example we need to go through quickly because we don't have a lot of time. Here's a C++ string class. Let's suppose you're doing your own string class. Of course, you're never going to. You shouldn't because it's in the standard library. But it's an example to get the point across. As you know, you might implement a string class with a character pointer, which points to data on the heap. The constructor will allocate data, and the destructor will deallocate. Boy, that was easy. Done, right? No, not quite. If you want to be able to copy strings, you also need copy and assignment capabilities. So the C++ programmer will quickly say, well, I know this because I know all about C++ objects. I need to have constructors and a copy constructor and an assignment operator and a destructor if I want this to behave as a value type. And so you quickly craft a copy constructor, as you see here, and an assignment operator. Okay, anybody see what I'm talking about here? Anything being repeated? Am I not doing the same thing all three times? I am allocating memory, and I am putting strings, characters in that memory. In the constructor on the previous page, in the copy constructor here, and in the assignment operator here. So what should I do? I say, oh, I'm repeating myself. I'm going to factor that code out into its own little function. Give it a name, we'll call it dupe here. And I will make it so it can be used in all three places. And now I turn around and I rewrite my code and it looks like this. My code is shorter, it is easier to read, and I do not have to go to three different places if I find a better way to do what I was doing. Just like you don't have to redefine your constants in different places when you change them. Code duplication is bad, whether you do it explicitly or whether you fail to see duplication as code evolves. Words of wisdom. The competent programmer is fully aware of the strictly limited size of his own skull. He means brain. Therefore, he approaches the programming task in full humility, and among other things, he avoids clever tricks like the plague. So very important. Some of you are in my 4450 class right now, and you know that we evaluate the quality of programming languages by their readability. And that has to be true with the code that you do as well. And you don't want to be too clever because you will confuse yourself. Now, I want to be clear about one thing. I'm not talking about that you have to make the world's most beautiful code and that you're going to waste time just making something look better. I'm not talking about cosmetics, although that's part of it. It's nice to have good-looking code because it's readable. That's just a very small part of it. I'm not talking about adding bells and whistles or things that are not needed. That is not what code quality is. I'm just talking about those attributes of real stuff. You know, like something should be robust. It should handle all error conditions for which it's intended. It should give me the right answers, and it should be something that can last because it's maintainable. That's called gold plating, by the way, adding the bells and whistles and just making it pretty because you put on your aesthetic hat and you just want to make a work of art. And that's not what I'm talking about. And that's what the managers think we're talking about, but that's not what we're talking about. All right, so let's now, as we wind down here, let me just throw at you very quickly some practices that work. I've already hinted at some of them. And this is the real meat of it, of course, and we need to have a discussion sometime of these things. These are the things that are integrated into our curriculum, or should be. Number one is don't repeat yourself. I've already told you that. Ooh, I repeated myself then, didn't I? Dang. You know what I mean. Find invariants and assert them. Ooh, what is that? Well, if you've had my classes, you know. This is one of those ways of coming up with correct software right from the beginning, because you think about what you're doing and you say so. I can't tell you any more about it right now. Design in terms of interfaces. Don't think implementation too quickly, because you want to fully separate interface from implementation. You know why that's important. Another way of saying that is minimize coupling, maximize cohesion. You've heard these things. Extreme programming suggests that we do test-first programming. Write our tests, then the code that we test. There's reasons for that. Pair programming is a good idea, not necessarily 100% of the time. But it's good to have someone to code side by side with from time to time. You want to automate things. You want to do things a piece at a time. Here's one that we need to do more of. Study good code. How do they teach writing? You read a lot of good works, and you do some writing. Same thing needs to happen with programming. Prefer talent over knowledge. I'm going to talk about that in a minute. And here's some more practices that if you download these slides, you can just read. We don't have time to go through them now. Let me just explain the postpartum illusion here. We used to call, Roger will remember, we used to talk about postmortem debugging, right? That's what we would do. Postmortem meaning after a run of a program failed, we'll look at a hex dump and see what happened. That was called post-mortem debugging. Aren't you glad you don't have to do that? To read pages and pages of hexadecimal? Well, that was fun. We ought to make them do that. Let's make them do that. Yeah, it'd be good for them. It'd be good for them. Yeah. Anyway, the thing is that after we release something, we need to have reviews of what we've just done. And that's where that refactoring can come in as well. Okay, well, we need to finish up here, and so I'd like to summarize some principles here. When I say talent versus knowledge, this is extremely important. We are an industry of buzzwords. Whatever the latest sexy technology is. And I don't know what the latest one today is, I'm afraid. But all I did was I looked at the books on my shelf and I wrote these down. XML, XSLT, Genie, JNI, J2EE, C++, STL, Bluetooth, SOAP, the list goes on. And we have this tendency to think that if I know these things, I'm cool, I'm valuable. Yeah, well, these things change so fast now that if you know them now, they don't mean a lot tomorrow. There's something more fundamental that needs to be mastered here to produce quality. It's not just knowing the buzzwords and knowing how to push some buttons or knowing how to write XML. These are tools that deliver quality, but they are not the substance of quality itself. The substance is what we've been thinking about. So here's what I'd like you to take away. The first slide is for the faculty, which are not here. I think there's only two faculty members here. But here are some suggestions. Well, actually, there's three. Of what we as UVSC faculty can do, and we're actually doing some of these, and maybe you've seen these in your classes. We want to provide more realistic projects, including team projects, and we have some senior level courses that are going to be doing these. Of course, if you're doing a compiler, that's one of them. So if you're in the CS track, you'll be doing a compiler. That's a realistic project. We need to have students read and modify existing code, sizable programs. Let's read those. Let's walk through those and learn from them and also make suggestions, because that's what we do in industry. We need to do a lot of mentoring, not just lecturing. And I'm really impressed with the way Roger puts together his classes. He's the mentor for 1250 and 1350. His slides are wonderful, but what he does is he goes through the slides and then he does some hands-on. And I've been doing that lately myself in my class, and I have really been enjoying that. We develop code on the fly, right there in class. We talk about it, we design it, we implement it real time without even thinking ahead of time about it. And then, of course, we need to incorporate these important practices that we've been talking about. I teach design patterns in my course, extremely important way to develop good code. Agile development, that's the current name for something that extreme programming is part of. And then, of course, we have to really know our language and teach proper use. So that's what we can do. What can you do? Got your pencils ready? Number one, would you please care? Would you please care enough to do your very best, as they say? Care enough that you want to be a good programmer and not just get by and that pull that job security joke that student did on me. Proactively better yourself. Seek competence, not just a grade or a degree or a title. If you're just here to get a degree, I'm worried about you. If you're here to be worthy of that degree, then that's something else. And you need to constantly read and apply what you learn. I graduated with my bachelor's in 76. I've been reading ever since then. I haven't stopped. It's important to be an ethical programmer, to be honest with yourself and with others, to be honest about what you can and can't do, to be willing to try something new, but always give honest, direct feedback to those that you work with. And be accountable for what you do and clean up after yourself. Decide to reduce the debt. So let's end with just some quick words of wisdom. In times of change, learners inherit the earth, while the learned find themselves beautifully equipped to work in a world that no longer exists. And this happens in our industry every time we turn around. You have to keep learning. Here's one of my favorites. This is from Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, a wonderful book. When one isn't dominated by feelings of separateness from what he's working on, then one can be said to care about what he's doing. This is what caring really is, a feeling of identification with what one's doing. When one has this feeling, then he also sees the inverse side of caring, quality itself. I still have all the code I've ever written from the 70s. I've shown it to my class this semester, my old Fortran. Of course, they thought it was ugly, but that's beside the point. I care about what I do. And here's the last one. Seems obvious, doesn't it? The way to write a perfect program is to make yourself a perfect programmer and then just program naturally. But that's the truth. Any questions? Comments? Yes? Okay, the question is, My graph showed a pretty much a steady downturn in code quality, this graph here, during a release. And that is just reflecting the natural growing complexity of the project as it has to grow to meet its requirements. That was the idea there. So the more complex it is, the more the entropy sets in naturally. And because you're under time constraints, you do not have time to do it properly, but you need to go back and fix it. That's all that I meant. And I'm not sure that I can fully answer your question besides that. Okay, well, I hear the book's being packed up. It must be time to go somewhere, so I will say thank you. See ya. It really went quite well. We did notice that every few months or so, I don't know how many months, we probably did this, I'd say, three times in the life of the project, which was a year and a half, 2 years. We had to have a catch-up cycle. Where this cycle, we're not going to do anything new because we're behind. But, you know, it was our first time doing it. Nonetheless, it was a great way to do software, and I really think that we showed that you can do iterative development. You can use object-oriented technology. You can use it well and get good results.
But what made that project go so well? I mean, you were using Fusion, but was that because of the choice of good managers? You had good programmers, but was that also because of choices that were made? I mean, how did that thing
happen?
Yeah,
that's a good question. We actually did have a pretty good team put together, managers and developers alike. And we actually brought in, we tried several, okay? We used Rational Rows, and we were using the Booch methodology for a while, and we had some consultants come in to help us with that and with reuse in general. And that was okay. But as we got more experience and we asked better questions, we looked for some other things. And so we brought in some people from HP, and they were great. They really were great. And they sold us on Fusion, and it wasn't a big sell. I mean, I don't even know if they got anything from us other than their consulting fees. We just started using Visio. We stopped using Rational Rows, and, you know, there were some things we didn't like about it. And we just started using Visio just to do the drawings and just doing the code ourselves. And we were much happier with that. We felt like we were much more in control. But I think part of the reason is just that we did have a team of people who were open-minded at the time. And they really wanted to do a good job. And it was nice that for this window of time, we had management that trusted us as developers. And I was a development manager. And, you know, I had a lot of experience. And it worked well, and I had a good team. We worked well together. Our offices were right next to each other. It wasn't the XP model where there were no walls, because we all had our own office at this particular company, and that was very nice. We kind of liked that. But we got together all the time. You know, we were just all next to each other. We couldn't necessarily yell at each other, but all we had to do was get up and go to the next office and stuff.
Was there pair programming going on?
We did some of that. We didn't, again, know the term, but yes, Matt Fowler and I, he was a colleague of mine there. He was on the team. We would often sit down at the terminal together and code together and design on the fly, or we'd stop coding for a moment, go over to the whiteboard, draw some diagrams and say, yeah, that looks good, let's do that. And then we'd sit down and start programming together. Yeah, you bet. So yeah, we were doing XP really is an attempt at codifying what people have been doing anyway for a long time.
What do they say? Observation of programmers in the wild.
Okay, I wouldn't say we were in the wild. This was a conservative company, and like I say, it was fortunate that we had this window of hands-off managers, at least the higher-up managers, who trusted us and let us do what we wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And then the project manager and the other such folks that were on the team were pretty open-minded, and we worked well together. That was an important part of the mix.
So now you are, most of the programmers that you're teaching are fairly new to programming.
Well, not, yes, but not as much as you would think. This school that I teach at it serves Utah County, which is south of Salt Lake City. And it's where BYU is. And
It's not a typical university type environment where it's strictly academic. In a typical class that I teach, almost 50% of my students will be employed as programmers.
Oh.
Yeah, and a lot of them are you know, not your typical young college age. Occasionally I'll have a student older than me, if you can imagine. That's hard to do, but it has happened. At least I assume he was. Yeah, his son was in the class too, and he was pretty old. So maybe we were the same age, whatever. But by and large, yes, of course, the people that I teach, there's a small minority, a very small minority, who are really good, solid developers. They're really great. And they already have wonderful jobs, they're getting paid well, and they're just coming back to get their degree, or in some cases to pick up a class to fill in a gap that they may have. But by and large, we have either typical students or we have students who maybe are working, but they are inexperienced and they do need a lot of help.
So with, well, I guess with either of those students, but in particular with the new programmers, what do you think the biggest difficulties or biggest hurdles that they have to overcome are when they're trying to struggle into programming in the first place?
Well,
because, I mean, you know, you could say things like, well, some people never learn about pointers, for example, but there are some languages which
it doesn't matter
don't really have
yeah,
pointers.
Right,
I mean,
right. So
know.
Who cares? Yeah.
So, I mean, people who learn Java as a first language maybe could go through their programming life without learning what a pointer is.
Right. Well, the answer I'm going to give you is most certainly not what you're expecting nor what you want. But you asked, and so you're going to get the biggest answer, and then we can move on to topics of that answer. But the biggest difficulty we have at this particular school, and I wonder how true it is at other schools, is that the students need help in personal management, putting in the effort, knowing how to work, using their time wisely, really wanting it enough to put in the effort to master it. And, you know, it depends what school you go to. I would imagine if you go to a place like where Scott went, Brown University, maybe that wouldn't be the case because it's harder to get in there.
I had to go to, I mean, I was on my fourth, if you count a stint at a community college school before I kind of got the discipline to do homework. And that was because it was forced on me.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I'm not...
A lot of people don't comprehend the workload that puts on the professor to do a good job on that. And I have that problem in class. If I were to do everything I thought needed to be done, and I'm pretty close, but I don't have time to do it all, I would be working probably 80 hours a week to teach 3 courses.
Hmm.
And so sometimes you just can't do it all. You know, you just can't. But the thing is that if students would, on their own initiative, do the homework that we suggest that they do, do the projects, you know. In some classes we have homework and it's not programming, like in computation theory or in discrete structures. It's more of a math or a theory class. Well, some instructors don't correct the homework, don't collect it. They just say, do this if you want to understand it, and I'm just going to give you a test. Well, that would be fine. But if I did that in my classes, in all of my classes, I would have students failing right and left.
Because the stuff you're teaching is too hard.
They've got to do the work. They've got to do the work. If they don't do the work, they're not going to understand it. But if you don't give them credit, they're not going to do it. That's the kind of student I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But let me, you know, that's painting a pretty bad picture. And yes, it is true to some degree. At the same time, I have discovered that I am known at Utah Valley State College as somewhat of a difficult professor in the sense that I'm there to teach. I'm there to have them learn. I'm not there to play games and waste time. And so I make them work. And when I teach advanced C++, I have them do hard programs. And so I'll get some people that whine, and some people that try to get more points out of me. But by and large, when the thing is all over with, the people that have survived have had a wonderful experience. And I generally get, you know, pretty good response from the students saying, boy, they learned a lot. But I just kind of feel bad that we have a good chunk of students that are not really ready. Now, I don't know if this applies to the workplace or not, but I think it might. I think if you go to the workplace, you will see that there, you know, there's this kind of stratification of employees as well. There's going to be the bottom dwellers who are just there to fill space, and they're not really into what they're doing. And that may have a lot to do with some of the poor code quality that's out there. And then there are other employees who really care about what they're doing. They like it. It's fun. They like learning. They like being able to increase their power of being able to create software solutions. So
those would be, well, possibly that might not be the only characteristic of this mythical 5% of programmers that are 20 times more productive than the other 95%.
Yeah, and I've heard that, and we talked about that at the summit in January, and you know, I don't know how true that is, it's okay with me if it's true, but I don't know. But yeah, mm-hmm. It could be. Well, I suppose I do see some of that in the students. The top students grasp things fairly quickly. They really put in the time. They don't wait to the last minute to do stuff, and they get it. Jamie, for example, the assistant that we have working together with us in the book, I've never known anybody to work so hard as he would do. He would come into my office during my office hours, and he had already composed a list of examples that he's been trying to work through to understand what I taught, examples in addition to the ones I showed. And then he would have a large list of questions on things he didn't understand, and we would go over it together. He just really wanted to learn. So we'll get some students like that, and then we'll get some pretty average students, and then we'll get some other students that they really ought to change their major.
Mm-hmm. So,
anyway, I don't know how to answer the question. I do know that some just get it, and some do not.
Well, my experience with interns was that they generally needed structure, which I wasn't prepared for. I assumed that I could say, here's the task that needs to be done, go do it, and that I wouldn't have to provide the structure as well as the task.
But of course, we have that structure in a classroom situation, pretty much.
Or you can. Well, you mentioned some professors don't require homework, and without that structure. I mean, that's how I started in the first couple of years in college, and we go, oh, so that means I don't have to do homework.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. And it wasn't until I went to Irvine and some professor said, oh, and of course, and I think it was kind of a school-wide thing, is that, you know, homework was not an optional thing.
So it was part of the grade.
It was part of the grade. It was, I mean, you were being watched from the beginning to end, and so suddenly I had to straighten up. And of course, now I look at it and I say, well, all the loss of learning that I had in the previous situations because I felt like, you know, homework was optional. Yeah. And it's too bad, but it's the same kind of structure I felt like I had to promote.
Right, yeah, you learned your lesson.
Well, I did, and the thing is, it makes one, you know, what I was hoping for was something like a computer or a compiler or something where you say, all right, here's the task, do it. And then, you know, it comes out and it's done the way it's supposed to be done. And what I discovered is, no, I would, you know, if I take on somebody, that means that I have to pay a lot of attention to them. And so it's not like I could just say, here's a task, do it. Now my abilities are suddenly amplified because the amount of time that I have to put in to monitor them cuts way into the time that I have to be productive.
Right.
So it's not such an easy...
And that's why you really have to pick people pretty well, too. I mean, like I brought up Jamie. We did a good job there. Because
mm-hmm.
Jamie is the kind of guy that we could give something to do, and he would go do something with it mm-hmm. and come back. And when he came back, he had something done. And more times than not, it was what we wanted. But even if it wasn't, he asked the right questions, and then he went and got it done. So a lot of it is personal. But as far as the work goes, I mean, it's obvious to us, and it should be obvious to everyone, you learn to code by coding. You learn to do whatever by practicing it. I was a math major. My 3 degrees were in math. And so can you imagine someone getting a math degree and never doing any math problems? Never doing proofs and never...
It's kind of all that it is.
That's right. And so all the way through graduate school, there was no such thing as not doing homework. It was everything you did.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, you had your tests and your final. But if it wasn't for the homework, you'd royally fail your test and your final.
Right.
And so I don't know what to say. There are a lot of developers out there who just kind of sit there and want people to direct them and push them around and say, do this, do that. And and to spoon feed them training, for example. I've seen a lot of that, not only where I've worked, but where I've taught as a consultant.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty bad. And at the same time, there are those who really care. When I do find that when I give my students good meaty stuff, you know, like in Advanced C++, we do a lot of practical stuff. We get into the depths of templates. I took a day and I talked about metaprogramming, and we didn't have time in this particular semester to do a project on metaprogramming. But at least I was able to show them some neat stuff and some expression templates and whatnot. And boy, they ate that up. They thought, wow, this is cool. You know, they never thought of the fact that a compiler can actually do logic. I mean, you know, actually you can program the compiler to do stuff that's already done by the time you're in the program. They were very, very impressed.
Mm-hmm.
So I find that, especially in the classes beyond the beginning classes, if you really give them some meat, of course, doing it in a nice methodical way so that they're ready for it, that they really like it. And the best students will rise to the occasion. Even those who are pretty average will try. And there's always those on the bottom you can't do a lot about.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the way it is.
So if we assume that the main difficulty that people have in learning is just structuring their process, perhaps that would be the best way to put it. You said that there were some other categories that might be a little more programming specific.
I forgot. Did I? Oh, you mean because some of my classes aren't and some of them are?
Well, we're just talking about the hurdles. I mean...
Oh, I see what you mean.
Guess...
Oh, right. Okay, I got you. I'm with you now. Yeah, so the first answer that we just exhausted, of course, is the fact that it's kind of a personal discipline thing or a motivation thing. So other difficulties. And this is important too. I kind of disagree with some of the prevailing popular ideas on presenting programming to people. I think that a lot of people like to go with what's hot, with what's sexy, with what the hype is, you know. And part of that happened when Java became very popular. All of a sudden, all of the countries, all of the universities in the country were changing to Java.
And so did yours.
We did too, as a matter of fact, yes. And what we found was that we were losing people. On the very first day of class, you've got to see public static void main.
And class.
String args. And you have to see class and all this stuff. And so this scaffolding that has to be there, because Java is an object-oriented language, very much so. Is that really a good idea to do that right out of the chute? Well, a lot of people still think it is. They're really sold on it. But I am not.
But they don't see the process of new people coming in every day.
Well, I mean, I'm still talking about professors as well.
Oh.
I mean, there are I'd say most now of the computer science departments throughout the nation are using Java as the initial language. They've moved from C++. And, of course, I talked to you earlier today that, you know, I know of at least one that's using Python. But if people would just remember why object orientation is here in the first place. Object orientation evolved as a means to manage large projects, to manage complexity in software engineering. And that's wonderful, and that's what it's for. And I still have fundamental disagreement with giving that to students in the very beginning who have never done any programming. I just don't think it's a good idea. For example, look at the way the industry has gone. And Dan Sachs brings this principle up, that for a person, even nowadays, to learn programming, they're going to, in some way, have to go through what the industry went through. The industry started off with very low-level things, you know, machine language, assembly language. And I'm not saying you have to learn that first. But you have to learn something at a manageable level that you can grasp immediately. And then you can build the higher levels of abstraction. And that's where classes come in. So, for example, if you want to start teaching programming, what better way to grab someone's attention and to start on the page where they're at than to talk about simple computations. Let's talk about ints. Let's talk about numbers and do this and do that. And before you know it, they're programming, doing simple computations. And before you know it, they're doing functions. And so that can be done so easily and so quickly in any language you want, except it's kind of hard in Java because there's all this stuff and we say, well, don't worry about that for now. Just do it. We'll get there, you know. And it's just noise. You know?
Some people can do that and other people go, but what is that?
Yeah, right.
And it adds to their level of, it takes up many of their 7 ± 2 things that
right.
you can hold in
And I'm kind of that way too. I really like to know mm-hmm. to some level of comfort what is going on. And so the analogy I always use, because I'm a mathematician, is you learn algebra before you learn calculus. Mm-hmm. To try to teach somebody calculus and say, well, don't worry about the algebra, we'll get back to that. Yeah, very funny. It just doesn't work that way. It's calculus is built upon algebra. And guess what? Objects are built upon functions and data. And so I still like the idea of starting where they are at, use something as simple as possible. And we can get to objects soon enough. Yes, we can get to them, of course, in the first semester, easily, as a matter of fact, in the first half of the semester. But let's not show them public static void main string args in class as their first programming experience. Now, how do some people get around this? Well, they have artificial environments. You know, they'll have some other program which does that for them invisibly, so that the programmer just types in simple things and they are by default in part of some default class, you know.
You could do that with Jython, actually.
Well, you can do it lots of ways. Yeah, mm-hmm. Sure you can. But my question is, fine, okay, but we're teaching them a language that doesn't really exist, and if they still have to learn those basic things first, well, then let's use a tool that's just really made for the job. And so my feeling is I would rather use C/C++ in the beginning and then get to Java when we need to, when they understand what a big project is and when they see that, oh boy, things can get really complex. I need to manage this stuff. And classes and objects do the job, of course. So I'd rather have them get a lot of confidence first mm-hmm. with the things that we should give them, you know, the smaller examples to get the principles down.
But of course, even C, you have to know the pound includes
right.
and functions.
I said I would rather use C than Java, but to finish the thought, my current thinking is Python is the ideal way to go.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking earlier today that I have a colleague that teaches Python as the first programming language. Matter of fact, I was talking to one of my fellow professors a couple of months ago about this, and I thought, you know, but there's a problem with this. If we used Python, we would cover so much in the first semester, there wouldn't be anything left to teach them. In other words, the first semester, we'd probably be teaching them the equivalent of what we do in 3 semesters with other languages and tools. So we'd have to kind of be careful there that we don't overdo it. But that's kind of funny anyway.
That's about the worst, yeah. that's not so bad. Yeah, if you learned the concept in Python, then you could go back and you could look and you say, oh, I see.
Right.
Java has collections in a library, but it does the same thing as lists and dictionaries in Python, and I know what those are supposed to do, and the rest of it's just noise that I can ignore. Maybe that's one of the keys, is learning what the noise is and
well,
what to ignore.
What to leave out. That's always the big question. As a matter of fact, on Alistair Coburn's email, on the bottom he has this quote from The Little Prince. It's in French. But it's that quote that says, perfection consists not in knowing what to put in, but in what to leave out. And I think that's true. I think we need to leave out everything we can. And so what's left is what needs to be there. And there's no absolute answer on that, but I think that Python's the best thing I've seen so far. Scheme is not bad, but its syntax is kind of weird. I think Python is a lot better. But I teach both Python and Scheme in my senior programming languages class. And it's interesting, they don't get that until they're a senior, unless they've picked up a little Python in a web programming class or something. And it's really kind of backwards, because that's where we talk about the principles of programming languages. And we get into a lot of depth of, you know, why is this language designed this way? And we talk about neat things you can't do in other languages, you know, that, and why are they there, like closures, function closures, and things like that. And it's too bad they don't see that kind of stuff sooner, because it's so simple to do it with Python or Scheme. But as it is, I've got to wait until they've had all these semesters of C++ and Java and compilers and operating systems, and then finally near the end of their career, we dig into the principles of programming languages. And again, they have the same aha experience,
mm-hmm.
you know, of, oh, and it helps them understand the languages better that they already know.
Right, but once, I've had this experience myself, once I understand these concepts, I can go back and look at languages that I struggled through and see them so much more clearly and simply.
Yeah.
And know what aspects of them are noise or really not so important. Whereas when you're learning, I mean, for example, when you start learning, oh, I don't know, namespaces or even templates, you know, you look at templates and you see how complex they are. And there's a something in the back of your mind that says, well, they must be really important then because they're this complex.
Because they're so complex.
They're so complex.
We wouldn't go through all this trouble if we didn't need them.
Otherwise, right, exactly. And it took me, I mean, I had to learn Python and begin to understand what, you know, weak typing was mm-hmm. before I could go back and say, oh, that's sort
what's
of
going on with template
that's
arguments.
What templates yeah. are pretty much about. You know, I mean, it's happening at a different time, et cetera, but still, right. you're able to say, I don't care exactly what type you are. I just know that you can right. accept these messages, and that's what I want to do.
And 40 years ago, if someone had studied Lisp, they already would have known that.
Mm-hmm.
Lisp is pretty much the same way.
Right.
And so that's why I choose Scheme and Python in this languages course, so they can see a couple of dynamically typed languages and see the flexibility and the power. And yeah, it's true, it doesn't do static typing, but hey, they do fine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's another discussion.
That's a whole other discussion.
Which we could get into, I suppose,
no,
if we wanted
I don't,
to.
Yeah, I don't think so.
I don't think so. Let me just interrupt. I just want to bring to closure this thought. For those that are listening, let me just say that at Utah Valley State College, yes, we did go back to using C++ in our initial programming language course. And yes, I had a lot to do with that. But I didn't get a lot of argument, I'll tell you that.
Hmm.
I really didn't. And so that's where we're at.
So because of the high overhead, the many burnt offerings
that you offer to the JVM.
Yes,
necessary. The Java compiler,
To get things done, decided it was simpler to go back to C++.
Of course, and Bill Vinners would cry heresy at this point. I think he's one of those that would definitely say, you went back to C++ from Java.
Hmm.
And I do get a lot of stares like, there's something wrong with you. You know, you
from students or from?
Oh, no, from other professionals.
Oh, I see.
They think I need to go to therapy or something.
Because
we went back to C++.
Java is the accepted religion now. So,
yeah.
Have you found that the learning curve is easier with C++?
It's too early to tell, but from the classroom experience, just as an anecdotal response,
mm-hmm.
I would say yes. What we used to do is we taught Java in the first semester and then C++ in the second.
Mm-hmm.
I ought to add, for those who are listening that are into academia or know about how it's structured, we actually in our school take two semesters to do what a lot of schools would do in one semester. We take two semesters for the initial indoctrination into programming before they get major data structures in a third semester.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we have our reasons for doing that. A lot of it is just experience. So what we used to do is we taught Java in the first semester and C++ in the second. And part of the problem we had there was, of course, the language shift. You know, that was a bit of a problem. But we also found that by the time people got out of the Java class, they didn't hardly know anything.
Mm.
I mean, they had trouble comprehending what a class was and what an object was. They honestly did. And I think part of the reason is because it was thrown at them in the beginning without the background to understand. And so a lot of them never really did get it. In other words, they didn't take that incremental approach, the algebra to calculus approach, to understand objects, unfortunately. And so we had to reteach everything.
Hmm.
That's the thing. I was teaching the second semester course in C++, and I kept having to reteach everything.
Hmm.
And so obviously we were wasting our first semester. It wasn't a good idea.
Hmm.
Now, some people would say, well, why don't you just use Java for the second semester and don't switch languages? But I'm saying by the time they finished that first semester, they still didn't know what they needed to know. Something didn't work.
Hmm.
And I don't know what it was.
Hmm. So how do you think a programmer becomes mature?
Well, that's a good question. First of all, experience. You can't think it. You don't think your way into maturity alone. You have to do, you have to practice, you have to try. You have to just be brave and do stuff.
And make mistakes.
And yeah, you got to make a lot of mistakes, honestly. Mm-hmm. That really is the way to do it. And of course, with the fast turnaround we have with computers nowadays, and that's another story, I could tell you some interesting stuff from the old days, but we won't do that. With the fast turnaround we have nowadays, you can make mistakes and get an immediate response. Unless, of course, it's a template error, in which case you can't understand it.
You get a huge response.
Yeah, you do. An unintelligible response. And so it's, you know, it's like having a tutor right there, so to speak. But anyway, yes, I would say that a person needs to have experience, they need to try things, not to be afraid to make mistakes. That was, let me just hark back to the example I gave you of this really neat development team I was on, where we were doing XP and didn't know it. We had brought a number of consultants in. One, as a matter of fact, you know, I won't mention his name at this point. And we wanted to get, quote, help on getting up to speed and doing what we needed to do. And what we wanted to do, as I said before, was to get some kind of a reusable layer, some class library, which can be used as a persistence framework in a three-tier client-server environment, and then go from there. Well, for almost a year, we brought in a number of consultants, and this one I just alluded to a number of times, and we weren't getting anywhere. We just didn't have that feeling like, ah, okay, we know what direction we're going. We kind of felt like we were just being tossed back and forth. And as I look back at that, I think it was the fear on our part of just doing our own work and trying our own ideas. And so finally, I said to myself, after almost a year of this analysis, almost analysis paralysis, I said, I've had enough of this. And I pretty much threw out the window all the stuff that we got from the consultants. And I just thought, how would I solve this problem?
What's the simplest thing that could work?
And that's exactly what I did. I started with the simplest thing. I started with this little kernel of something so simple. It was just, you know, like a function. And the next thing I knew, I had a class. And the next thing I knew, I had a set of cooperating classes. And I kept iterating on this with my colleagues, you know, who knew the requirements a little better than me. I was the development manager. I wasn't the analyst. And it was amazing how quickly we got an executable core that we could build on. And that's where the whole thing came from. And I ended up writing on this in the journal, and it's in my book, and I've talked about it at SD, and it's been used at many, many companies. And I've gotten feedback from all over the world on how good it is. And it's just because I decided to throw away that fear of saying, well, I've not done this before, therefore I can't do it. I better talk to the experts. And, talking to the experts in this case wasn't a lot of help.
I've consulted in situations where I was wondering, why did this group hire a consulting firm where they seemed to be entirely competent to me? And so it was very frustrating because I wanted this team to do the work, because by working with this other team, they were disempowered. And I think that might be one of the problems of a lot of consulting relationships, is that it's kind of about empowering the consultant and thus disempowering the team. Whereas a good consultant would say,
work your
way
out of a job.
I want to teach you to fish.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I'm not giving you fish.
Well, as I look back over my 25 years now in this business, I can see kind of a pattern that has worked for me. And it's simple. And I'm sure everybody knows it and already does it. But it all started with, first of all, wanting to know. Remember, I was a math major, okay? And I didn't have anything to do with computers until I was a senior. And I almost skipped it. And somebody said, well, you know, and I think it was a student. And then it was corroborated by a professor later. You know, you really ought to take this Fortran class. You ought to know something about computers if you're a math major. And I kept putting it off. I'm like, okay, well, finally I'll do it. So in my senior year, I took a Fortran 1 class. Pardon me, a programming 1 class using Fortran. It wasn't Fortran 1, it was Fortran 4. Anyway, that just kind of woke me up. I saw, oh, here is something I can do to solve problems using my mathematical brain, and yet this computer does the work for me. It just got me. You know, I got bit by the development bug. And so I immediately started moving toward programming. So when I finished my master's 2 years later, I got a job as a programmer. I had already taken several programming classes. But the point is I really wanted to know. And then when I got out on the job, I also found that not only did I want to know, I wanted to help other people know. It wasn't that I wanted other people to know that I knew. I wanted other people to know also. And so that's just, it's been a cycle for me, is I'll venture forth and learn something, kind of go out into the dark, not knowing what I'm doing, taking some steps and making some mistakes and doing stupid things, but then learning from that experience.
It's almost as if it's not complete until you can see the lights go on in somebody else's eyes.
That is it, you know. It's amazing. You don't really know something completely yourself, I think, until you try to explain to somebody else, until you try to teach it. And then you find that you have to get a deeper level of mastery. You really, really know it. And so that's what's been happening to me all along, is that I'll kind of run to the end of a list of things that I've been wanting to do, and then I'll say, what else is there to know? And maybe I'll rest a little while, but then something will come up. And of course, nowadays, you know, you hear about things everywhere, and you know, this industry of ours is so fast paced. And so then I'll just start it all over again. I'll just start tinkering and trying to master it, trying to understand it. And I cannot understand anything until I practice it. Now, other people may be able to do that, and they're much more bright. But I cannot fake it. I have got to have experience with something before I really know it. And then, as we just said, if you teach it to somebody else. So in my first job, just little things like we used punch cards at the time, and then we got these new terminals from IBM, these TSO terminals. Ooh, they were so cool. You had this little terminal node here connected by a long-distance network to a mainframe very far away, and we could actually do stuff without cards. And so we had to learn the new TSO environment. Actually, not just TSO, SPF, pardon me, Structured Programming Facility. And so I just dove right in, and I was pretty much the first one at this company to learn that. And so I wrote up a little manual for everybody else. And then a little later, I was asked to teach APL at a community college, and I didn't know APL. But they were really hard up, and the vice president says, well, you are a programmer, aren't you? And I go, yeah. And so I pretty much stayed 2 weeks ahead of the class, but I did a good job. Mm-hmm. I really did. It went well, and so I wrote up a manual on APL for my fellow employers or employees, and it just kept going like that.
Wow.
And the code capsule thing started the same way, and you know, all that stuff. So yeah, I think you've identified it a good thing. It's not complete until you've passed it on.
So, when working on this this book, I think both you and I have, since it's a more advanced book, Thinking in C++ Volume 2, I think both of us have had this experience where we go, wow, this language is just really hard.
Yes.
And it seems like...
Don't quote me outside of this interview, because the CUJ community won't like to hear this, but yes, it's there are details in there that are so... Well, I wanted to say demonic, but that's too strong. There are details in there that are so arcane and dangerous that it makes you wonder, how did this happen?
Kids, don't try this at home.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Although that's we're sort of telling them about that in the book, but
yeah.
I mean, you know, you need to know it if you're going to be a C++ programmer. But do you think the difficulty in the language? I mean, certainly, learning Java as a first language detracted from. I mean, it became a big stumbling block, and it seems like the difficulty in C++. Might detract from becoming a good programmer because...
Well, the difficulty in C++, I think, has its negative effects. It really does. I don't think necessarily it would detract from becoming a good programmer, but I see what you're saying. in order to effectively use templates, there's some things you need to know that might bite you. And so, yes, those are very similar to other noisy things that get in the way, if you mean that, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that. But, of course, it's interesting that as far as teaching programming, I still think it's better to start with something simpler than Java. That is, be able to present something simpler than with classes, which you can do with the procedural part of C or C++. But yeah, there's some stuff in C++ that drives me nuts, and you and I both know real experts in C++. I mean, you know, we're not stupid, and we know our stuff, and we're okay. But there are some people that you and I go to ask questions, right? Okay. There are some people who live and breathe C++ so much more than we do that when we run into something, we ask these people questions. And I'm wondering, how do these people do it? And I often say to myself, are these normal people?
Well, because I went through a phase where I was living and breathing C++, and
well, I did too.
Briefly, could have been considered one of those experts.
Well, and I've written about that. I was a C++ expert, I think, for about 2 months. Mm-hmm. Yeah, back there in about 19, no, about the time the standard finished, mm-hmm. Or just before that, I think. By the time my book came out, mm-hmm. I felt like I really had a handle on it. I now see that there are some things in there that not only do I not have mastered, I don't want to. Mm. I don't want to have to. I mean, it gets to the point where, no, I'm sorry, this is beyond the level of arcane detail that I want to have to tolerate. Mm-hmm. I don't want to have to worry about this.
But you know it enough to avoid it, so you wouldn't
do
want to put this in.
And I know some of the workarounds, that's true. And yeah, I actually pride myself in not being a language lawyer. I think I know the language quite well, but I'm not a lawyer. You know, I don't get down to the, you know, the metalinguistic level and argue about, you know, this nuance and that nuance. I like to get things done. I'm mm-hmm. an application programmer, and those things eventually get in the way of productivity, in my opinion.
Oh, yeah.
And so I would much rather use a language like Python, and a lot of people are doing this, as you know, and then use C++ when I need to get the speed or some flexibility that may not be available because of some low-level need. And of course, that's happening a lot. The boost.python package that Dave Abrahams wrote is being used by a lot of people, and... you know, Dave Abrahams is one of these people, by the way, that we're talking about, these experts that mm-hmm. that I go to when I have questions that are just over my head. And he uses Python enough and thinks high enough of Python to have written this interface package to allow him to easily use C++.
Which wasn't the first interface package.
Well, I mean, no,
there's,
of course.
There's at least a couple of others. Well,
sure,
but,
that come with a download.
But
yeah.
This one looks
this one is
like
clean.
The easiest. It's what you'd want. You just go class here in C++, class here in Python, magically make stuff talk to each other.
Yeah.
Don't bother me with the details.
He has hidden those details.
It's a beautiful job.
Very, very nice, yeah. Mm-hmm. But that's the point. Isn't that what we do as computer scientists? We always are getting new levels of abstraction. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm not bad-mouthing the C++ people because, I'm sort of one of them, and they're brilliant, and they're all well-intentioned. But historically, if you look at it, C++ is what it is because it rode on the coattails of C mm-hmm. and because of the compatibility issues there. And that was a very practical issue, a very practical approach, and sure. It was perfect. If it wasn't for that, C++ wouldn't be what it is today.
Oh, it's an evolution process.
Right. And furthermore, C++ or object orientation wouldn't be as popular as it is. C++ brought it to the masses, as we
know. Everybody now believes that objects are good.
Right, thanks to C++.
Exactly. You
know, they're just little tiny pocket niches of small talk or... Mm-hmm. You know, Objective-C or other languages that were being used, but C++ is what, you know, washed the masses into mm-hmm. into OO.
Well, now, one of the goals of OO was originally stated to be reuse, and a lot of what's happened, I mean, initially I think managers would even say, okay, we've got this language to make reuse easy, now go make reusable stuff so that we can cut our costs. Now, and of course it didn't seem to happen.
Well, again, that depends. And I'm, since you brought it up, when I told you that I was on this enjoyable development team doing some good persistent stuff, the name of the team was, let's see, I can't remember the name of the team, but we were the reusable code developers. I was an RCD, that was my title, mm-hmm. reusable code developers. Our reason for existing as a department was to develop reusable software.
Hmm.
And we did it.
Mm-hmm.
We did do it. I mean, it's still being used and reused to this day at that company. And we did manage to package things in a way that it was readily reusable. But it wasn't, you know, you still had to, you know, basically it was the old model where you inherited and then you did some tweaking.
Mm-hmm.
But it worked very mm-hmm. well, you know, and you just had to provide some certain things. I think templates are an excellent example of reuse. I mean, look at STL.
Well, at least the collections. I don't know how many people are using
about.
The algorithms.
Well, you got to be kidding. The algorithms are cool.
Well, they're cool.
I use them all the time.
But mainstream developers,
I wonder. And they would be better off if they would use them.
There's yeah, no but I don't. I think people grasp the collections easily. But the algorithms require, I mean, it's sort of a functional programming approach to things.
Well, sort of, yeah, I mean...
And it requires a shift in mindset in order to organize your code to use the algorithms.
But you can still use the algorithms to a large degree without having to use function objects and mm-hmm. customizing them, although often you'll want to mm-hmm. do that. And furthermore, in simple cases that do come up, you can just use functions instead of function objects. So you don't really have to use the functional paradigm mm-hmm. aspect of that, the functional programming paradigm. But I think that's part of what we're doing in Volume 2. I mean, if you look at our chapter on algorithms,
mm-hmm.
it's chapter 6, I believe.
Which I think I wrote most of.
You did. And I went through and rewrote
Fixed
a lot.
Fixed it up.
I did a lot of work in
I
there.
I believe you.
I did. But if developers were familiar with some of that, and it's not that hard to use those.
No.
I mean, when we talk about developing your own templates and the name lookup issues and template metaprogramming and things like that, those are really difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And those are hard to grasp. And you know, but to use an algorithm is not that hard. And the algorithm's there waiting to be used.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a perfect example of what computer science is all about. There's a new abstraction, and boy, is it reusable, because it's generic.
Mm-hmm.
It's so generic that not only can you apply it to a sequence of any type, but you can customize it if you need to by having your own function object to do what you need to do. And furthermore, you can combine these things in a nested fashion, so you don't have to hardly write any code yourself. You just have to combine them. But yeah, it does take some mastery to get that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But my students do that in the advanced C++ okay. class. They do a pretty good job.
So in the future, we may, since it's part of the standard, we may see it being adopted more and more.
So do you really think it's not being adopted by the algorithms?
Yeah, that's my sense, is that the algorithms aren't being used that much. Because
they're certainly used in the publications, even in the journal. Well, but see, remember our journal, the readers didn't see the look on your face there. You shrugged when I said that. But in our journal, in CUJ, the articles we get are from working programmers.
Mm-hmm.
And these are things they've done in the workplace.
Mm-hmm.
And they use the algorithms. So, I don't know, it would be interesting to measure that. But
yeah.
Suffice it to say that if developers are not using the algorithms, they're missing out on something. They definitely are.
Well, to sort of wend us towards a close, you mentioned that you have a list of the qualities of a good programmer. And I was wondering if we could kind of review some of those things.
What I have is my list from... our January summit.
Right.
We at the summit, what we did is we went around the room. Well, you have to understand is that who are we to get together and talk about what's good programming, right? Or what makes a good programmer? Obviously, we think we're okay, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, many of us had written books.
Well, so what?
Almost does everybody.
Does that make you a good programmer?
No, it means that you can write and publish a book.
That's right.
But
there were some people there who wrote books who had never done much programming.
But your first assertion was that one of the important things in learning programming was structure. And anybody who can write and get a book all the way through clearly has had some kind of structure. So maybe.
Yeah, well, maybe so they have potential.
Okay.
To be a good programmer. Anyway, what we did, this is for the people listening, is we went around the room and basically answered the question, what makes you so good? Why are you a good programmer? What is it about you, you know, that is that? And so that's the notes that I have here in front of me. And they're in no particular order, but some of the things we said were, for example, a sense of aesthetics. Now, some people think this is foolishness. I've actually talked to people, programmers, who think that the idea of aesthetics or any hint of elegance is a total waste. Don't waste your time. Just get the work done and get the code working. And that sounds like a practical approach on the face of it. But the problem with that is that you end up making messy code, which is very difficult to deal with. And that's not quality code. It doesn't really matter. I mean, it does matter, of course, that the code works, but that's not all there is to good code. It should more than just meet spec. It should be crafted in such a way that it has a quality about it that makes it changeable, updatable, and still be healthy. And it's hard to put, facts to that and how to do it, but we're making progress. Martin Fowler's book on refactoring is one of those, where he talks about code smells, you know, like here's some code. Obviously, there's something wrong with this code. What can we do to fix it, to make it in better shape, to make it healthier?
It's interesting because recently Robert Cringely, who writes on this PBS website, he came out against refactoring. He said, it's a waste of time. And of course, I don't know. I mean, I thought it was a bit strange because he's never really expressed himself much as a programmer, so I don't know what his real background is, but it was very interesting.
Yeah, well, let me just say that in this experience I alluded to earlier where I was development manager and we had great success and fast turnaround, refactoring, even though we didn't know the word at the time, was what we did all the time. All the time. When it was time to make a change, we wanted to fit it in nicely into the environment, into the context. And so we spent a lot of time refactoring, but we were setting records on getting code out and working. So, you know, the guy's out of his mind. Alrighty. So a sense of aesthetics was one of it, was one of the things brought up out of our group. Another one was pride in your work. You got some skin in the game. It's not that you're not punching the clock, but you're there really putting yourself into it. Because a lot of, well, I would say a good deal of software development is a creative effort. You're doing things that haven't really quite been done before, or at least you haven't done them before. If you had, then you'd try to reuse something you've already done, which is good, but a lot of times we create software and it is a very creative design process. And if you're not interested in it, if you're really not putting yourself into it, that creative flow never happens. And you'll get, you just don't create good stuff. Okay, what else? This is the next thing on the list, that it provides an outlet for creativity. Somebody had mentioned that as we were going around the room, is that for them it's a very much a creative endeavor. And that certainly is for me, and I know it is for you too. Accountability. Part of being a good developer is to be accountable for what you do and to not be afraid of that. There was a time, a couple of decades ago, when there was a big push to get people to do code inspections, and we would find a lot of developers didn't want to have anything to do with that. I don't want nobody looking at my code, you know, this is my personal stuff. It's like they wanted us to look at their underwear drawer or something, which is not what we were interested in, trust me. And my experience has been the opposite. Yes, I was, as a newbie, I was a little afraid I might get criticized, but you can do it in a way that is very open. And so anyway, accountability was another thing that would increase code quality quite a bit. If people are accountable for what they do and if they're willing to take suggestions and improve. The next thing I've got written here is kind of interesting. Attention to detail coupled with systems thinking. So a programmer certainly does have to have some ability to keep a lot of things in his mind at once. But at the same time, you don't want to lose sight of where you're at. You want to keep the big picture as much as you can. So it's kind of the think globally, act locally type thing. You want to be able to
steer the car.
Yes. Very good. I like that. Einstein said, never lose a holy curiosity. And those are interesting. That's an interesting choice of words. To be curious is one thing, but you can be curious about things that waste your time and waste your life. I think what he means is always have a curiosity about knowing and mastering things that matter. And so this is that inner drive to always improve and to increase your knowledge. So that's something that came up. And that's related to being an abstractionist. You know, when we start creating things, we get to a point where we can see a pattern emerge. And all of a sudden we'll create a new abstraction to manage this thing that has evolved over time. And that's how we've evolved all the way through computer science. And so I think that this ability to think abstractly and to glean an abstraction from empirical entities, empirical data or whatever, is a very important part of being a good programmer. No question about that. Otherwise, you get lost. That's part of staying on track, is you want to manage the complexity. Somebody mentioned you need to be almost autistic in your ability to focus. I don't know how true that is, but you do need to be able to concentrate and focus on a problem that is tenacious, and you have to be just as tenacious as the problem. So that
that seems to be a big thing, because there's so many distractions. It's so easy to get, well, I mean, look at the process of putting a book out. Lots of distractions, lots of things that, I mean, there's the real things, but then there's also lots of other things. I mean, you could fool around with computers.
And as a matter of fact, I did fool around for a while on my Linux box, which was not a good experience, actually. So for all you Linux people out there, I had my doubts about you. that's probably a heretical statement, too, at least in the open source movement. And just quickly going through some of the other things on the list, the idea of continually improving, but that's the idea of a holy curiosity, always wanting to learn. Another one is to want to make a difference. Some people, perhaps not as many as should be, are motivated by what they can do to make a difference in others, you know, to be of service, to make an impact on people. And that is a prime motivation for software development, because you don't always develop software for yourself and for you to play with. Sometimes you do, but if you're going to make a living as a software engineer, you're doing things for others.
Well, even actually open source is entirely for that.
Absolutely.
So
yeah, so it is.
That's the whole motivation.
And so that is a very powerful motivation.
Mm-hmm, clearly.
Right, and so someone who has that as part of their personality is likely going to be able to make a contribution. And so that's just a good idea. Now, it's probably worth mentioning, too, as we, I'm sure, about to wrap up here, that there's a social part to software development. I mean, it's true, yes, we can all sit down and write some things on our own, and we do that. But when it comes to real software and large projects, you don't do those alone. And so there's a social part to that. And so it takes this ability and inclination to cooperate, to work together. And also, we've talked a lot about what the programmer should do, but those that feed this programmer should also have certain things in mind. And I'm thinking of a mentor. And the reason I bring this up is because I was pretty fortunate in the beginning of my career. I had a mentor. His name was Bruce, by the way. Bruce W. Walker at Logicon down in Southern California, my first job after I finished my master's. It was a software engineer job doing Fortran. And PL. Oh, there was a language I forgot to mention. PLS, which is a version of PL1. He was good enough to, in a sense, take me under his wing. I mean, you know, he didn't hold my hand by any means, but he was there for me to ask questions. And he showed a willingness to answer those questions and to answer them well. And often he would get at the principles underlying the answer for me. And it was from him doing that and leading me through projects of the like I had never done before in school. Being there to answer questions, being supportive, being very straightforward and making suggestions, that really helped me grow as a programmer and to want to do better. And as a matter of fact, the conversations we would have sometimes in the lunchroom or something whetted my appetite to want to know more about computer science in general. And that, probably more than any one other single thing, is what motivated me to go back for my PhD and to study computer science instead of mathematics. Now, for practical reasons, I got my degree in applied math, but my minor was in computer science, and I took quite a number of graduate computer science courses, and that's what I was doing my research in. I just wanted to know. I wanted to know what he knew. So he was a great example, and he was very good about it, very kind about it. And I think that's a very important part. A mentor is a very, very important thing.
One of the things that Guido Van Rossum wanted to add, if you bring up Python and you type import this, it will list all of the basic the philosophies of Python, which is quite fun. I mean, things like simpler is better than complex and explicit is better than implicit, those sorts of one-liners. And at the conference this year, they were talking about adding, if anything should be added to this list of Python philosophies. And one of the things that Guido suggested was something to the effect of be gentle on the internet. Some readers are only 11.
Oh, well, now that you brought this up, this professor I mentioned, that a colleague of mine at UVSC, whom I told that if I taught Python, I'd cover too much, he has done an experiment with his 9-year-old son. Mm. He tried to teach him Java. Mm. He could not get it. Mm. He says, well, let's try Python. He's a Python programmer now. His son is doing very well.
Well, Dave Bartlett did the same with his 8-year-old son.
Did he?
Yeah, and the both boys got into programming. And then at some point they wanted to do more graphical stuff, which Python does support graphical stuff, mm-hmm. but not as simply as Visual Basic. Mm-hmm. So they went and started programming in Visual Basic. But the fact that they started and they have a foundation mm-hmm. made it possible for them to move on
exactly.
to another language.
And that gets us back to what I was talking about at the college. It's that foundation that we're trying to give to the beginning students. Mm-hmm. And so we want to use the simplest approach to get them to that mastery that they need to have. And that's why we switch from Java to C++. That's why I would love to switch to Python. Mm-hmm. But at this point, there's too much
shuffling around going on.
Well, yeah. That's part of it. You know, it's too soon to make another major change, but dragging the feet on the part of the other faculty members as well. They don't know Python. There's only mm-hmm. one other one that really knows Python. Mm-hmm. He uses it, you know, regularly. He also happens to like Java, though, mm-hmm. as well. And so I think politically I would have some difficulty. I just have to wait for them to retire. When they're gone, we'll do Python.
Right. Okay.
Or whatever else may come along at that point. But at the moment, it's looking pretty good.
Okay. Well, thanks for talking to us.
Well, it's been my pleasure to talk to you all.